Welcome, sports fans. We're your hosts, Carl,
Alex,
Jay, and this is Momentous Play.
Momentous Play is sponsored by Discount Games Incorporated. Discount Games Incorporated sells Guild Ball at the maximum discount allowed by Steamforge. Order $50 or more in product and receive free shipping on domestic orders or reduced shipping on international orders. You can find their web store at www.discountgamesinc.com.
Welcome to Momentous Play. At the start of the episode, we will start a stopwatch. After 30 minutes, an alarm will sound, and the podcast will conclude.
The clock has started. I am your host of Momentous Play, Jay, and here again this week, we have one Carl Chase. Hello, Carl.
Hey, how's it going?
And also joining us via the magic of the interwebs, we have one Alex Shaver.
Hello.
So this week's episode, we're going to be doing the question and answer podcast. So in about 3-4 weeks... be looking on Facebook, on the Momentous Play Facebook. You should give us a like, and you can post your questions on there. We'll have a thread going for it, and you too can have your questions answered on Momentous Play. So let's start with Chris Miller. He says, a while back, you asked for some topics of discussion. Here's one that came to mind recently. What are your thoughts on handling gacha abilities in this game? Primary examples would be the countercharge, goalie rush, and unpredictable movement. This is a topic that was covered on Chain Attack for similar abilities in War Machine. I'm curious if you feel any difference here. To me, the ability to pre-measure makes me think of this game as being less inclined to gacha, but then without it, these abilities lose a lot of their usefulness. I always feel bad when I catch someone with one of these, but then when I forget an opponent's ability and it affects me, I don't ask for or expect a take back. Thoughts?
This is a complex issue.
I don't really feel like there's a lot of gotchas in an open information game. I mean, if someone does something to you after you've read their card, that's on you.
Oh. Boosh. Carl, laying down the smack.
Taking shots left and right.
I think a lot of it, to me, depends on what type of game you're playing, who you're playing. So, you know, let's say someone's just bought into Guild Ball and they've looked through my cards at the start of the game, but it's still a lot of information to process, keep in mind, etc. So I do think that in that type of situation, that it's probably a good idea to, you know, tell your opponent, you know, if they look like they're going to be doing a charge towards someone with unpredictable movement, for example, to just remind them, you know, keep in mind this player has unpredictable movement. So, I don't know. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that it should just be suck it up, buttercup?
Gachas are kind of unique in this game and in other games that have these because they don't necessarily have to be marked physically on the table, unlike a lot of other abilities that need to be marked in order for like them to take effect. So I think like in the heat of the moment, especially if you're running in a timed environment and or you're playing against somebody for the first time, I think it's perfectly reasonable to forget about things like unpredictable movement. And also I think it's even more reasonable to forget about goalie rush or keeper rush, I don't remember what it is, but the counter charge that goalies get when they're within 4 inches, because there's a condition for that to be met. So, like, not only do you have to know that it exists, you also have to know, which you can, obviously, it's an open measurement game, you can figure this out anytime you want to, but you also have to know if they're within 4 inches of the goal. And it's something that you have to process and realize and think about every time you move a model. And because of the size of the pitch, things like counter charge are really, really strong in this game because they go very, very far comparatively. And they can, I mean, completely disrupt, you know, upwards of 8 influence allocated to Obulus who wants to move and somebody counter charges and he does unpredictable movement stupidly or something crazy happens and you screw yourself out of the majority of your turn. As in terms of like how you handle that as a player, like you said, Jay, I agree. It just kind of comes down to what are you wanting out of the game? Like, if it's not that big of a deal, then like let them take it back. It's not hard to put a model back, especially once you've measured. Because it's open information, it's not hard to figure out where a model has been because again the pitch is so small and it's not, you know, challenging, especially out of full charge, to measure 6 inches back or whatever. But like, the biggest thing for me is, like, you just have to set a precedent early, and you have to stick to it. Because when you start changing, then it starts to feel manipulative, and it no longer becomes, like, it no longer really feels like an open information game because you're concealing the information that I may change my mind at some point as far as how lenient I'm going to be, and I think that can be really shitty.
Absolutely. If you're overly worried about gotchas or your opponent having gotchas, maybe have a notepad. Write some stuff down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Give it to your opponent and be like, hey, this is a reminder. These guys have these abilities, you know? And so it's always there, you know?
That's a super good idea. I like that idea.
It would also be kind of interesting to see if it, I don't know if this would take off or not, but there was a while where I had some tokens that had, that were basically little exclamation points that were standing up, exclamation points, little tokens. And, you know, it would potentially be interesting if you, let's say I read through Carl's cards, see that, you know, Obulus has unpredictable movement. I wonder, how would you feel if your opponent asked to place a token next to your model to remind them, to remind your opponent that about that ability?
I'd be fine with it. I wouldn't have any issues with it.
I think it's something where I think it would, the polite thing to do, obviously, would be to say, hey, do you mind if I place this next to your character to remind me of this ability? I don't think that, you know, you're like just kind of force the issue or whatever, but I think that if you approach the topic gracefully, that a lot of people won't have an issue with it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, I don't know, I usually try to go more along the lines of what's possible for a player. And this is, I guess, more of a War Machine mindset. If someone tells me, like, I'm going to attempt to do this, then we try to work out how they can make it happen. But mm-hmm. I don't know if it works as well in this game or not. It seems like it should, but...
He actually says something in this question that I kind of want to address, if that's okay. He says, to me, the ability to pre-measure makes me think of this game as being less inclined to gacha, but then without it, these abilities lose a lot of their usefulness. And I kind of disagree with that sentiment that without being able to surprise an opponent with something, like, it's lost its usefulness, because if they're thinking about it, then it's affecting how they're playing, right? Like, if I don't want to get knocked down by Brick's countercharge, then I'm probably not going to move within 6 inches of Brick. And I'm not being surprised by Brick's countercharge in any way, shape, or form, but it's very drastically affecting how I move about the pitch.
Right. So
I
think you're controlling the spacing of the game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Alex, did you have a question that you wanted to go over?
I like this one from Joshua Pearson. What are the best demo teams to try and start a meta with? He also says he doesn't want the game to go the way of all other niche miniature games, i.e. no one plays them, which we all, of course, don't want. So what do you guys think? What do you think the best two teams are to demo the game with?
Well, I've done quite a few demos using the Fishermen and the Butchers.
That's kind of the classic pairing, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I believe that's what Steamforged has the intentions of demos being done with. The two factions are fairly straightforward, and I mean, they're fairly easy for players to grasp, and it gives you a real taste of what these factions can do.
What's in the Butcher starter? I don't remember.
It comes with ox, brisket, and boiler.
That sounds right. So yeah, you get like a good mix there of ox, who's kind of a traditional just face beater, and brisket, who can score goals like nobody's business, and brisket, who's like an excellent support piece. So I think that works out well. I kind of feel like it falls a little bit apart with the fishermen, just because that butcher starter can kind of do it all, and fishermen, you know, are notorious for being unable to kill anything except like over the course of 100,000 turns. So maybe there's a better choice there somewhere where, like, you have a starter that can score, beat, and support really well, but I don't know. I don't know, maybe the Mason starter? I don't remember what's in that one, though.
It comes with Honor, Harmony, and Mallet.
Yeah, so, like, maybe the Honor, Harmony thing is a little janky because of the dual activations being kind of messed. So maybe if you replace Harmony with somebody else, like Flint, but Flint might also be too nut stompy of a striker, but if you're demoing the game, it shouldn't really matter that much, so I don't know. Something to think about, I guess. Jay, what do you think?
I think that I would. My inclination is to default with what the company says, just because I'm assuming that they're gonna they know the game better and put more thought into it than I have. but also, I think that if you have multiple guilds available, and if a player says, you know, aesthetically, I'm most interested in the Morticians. I don't necessarily think that it's an issue for you to do a demo game with them playing the Morticians. So I think that their interest level can change at some as well. Mm. Carl, do you have a question for us?
I thought it was kind of interesting.
You should read into the mic.
That'd probably be better. Yep. But then I can't see through the screen.
That's also true.
It's a trap. Phil Bowen says, what's your prediction for the overall U.S. scene a year from now? And I thought that was kind of interesting. A lot of games, they just kind of fall off the map and they get lost in the shuffle. But I think Guild Ball stands on its own, and I think it's going to be a big deal. I mean, it's already worming its way into other U.S. conventions as smaller events, and I can only see it going. The sky's the limit.
So I haven't talked about this yet on the podcast, but one of the things that I am looking towards trying to do is having been the organizer of a Guild Ball event in America that is kind of a War Machine Weekend style event, where most likely it would happen in the spring of 2017, and so there would be 1 year of events taking place in 2016, where there would be 7 qualifiers, and then the 8th qualifier would be at the Guild Ball event, and that 8th qualifier would be like the last chance qualifier, and then basically there would be, you know, those 8 players playing against each other for an American championship for Guild Ball.
Take that, UK.
That's right. And
the American Revolution all over again.
Like, in my heart of hearts, I want to call it the Guild Ball World Series, just because it's such typical American arrogance. But, you know, I think that the game is going to continue to grow domestically in the United States. I know that there are some distributors who are talking to Steamforge to try to pick up the game. I know that there have been a lot of stores who, I think that that's going to help the growth of the game domestically. I think that that's an important step for the game. And, you know, I think that the game is solid. I think that their organized play is solid. And so I am excited that I think that it has the possibility of being something that gets established as a exciting product to play competitively. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Alex?
I don't know. I think a lot of Guild Ball's success in the United States has maybe a bit to do with what its competitors are doing also. Like, I think there's no illusions of the fact that Guild Ball is taking is probably not the right word, cannibalizing probably not the right word, but like is influencing a lot of people who have played War Machine Hordes for a very long time to move to that because it's new and it's exciting and it's different and all of the other things that we could probably do a whole episode on why that it's happening. But I also think that a part of that is because right now things are in kind of a lull for War Machine Hordes, and so it's easy to generate interest. I think if something were to change drastically there might be a decline in Guild Ball. So I think right now it's a really important time for Guild Ball to get really aggressive about creating that U.S. scene, like in a really significant way. And it's not necessarily all Steamforge's responsibility there, right? Like it's also kind of our responsibility as people with a voice and YouTubers like Armada Games and those guys, to help build that. So I think that as long as the people who are, I hate saying like in the limelight, but like, in the limelight about Guild Ball can keep that fire roaring, I think that it will become, you know, another game that is played in the United States in a really significant and interesting way. I think there's a lot of potential there. I think there's a lot of like hope, so to speak, for Guild Ball. But it takes work, so it depends on how much work everyone's willing to put into it.
Yeah,
you hear that, Jay? The Guild Ball World Series carrying the torch through the nation.
Jay, Guild Ball success is exclusively your responsibility.
Carry the torch through the world, Carl.
Oh, through the world.
That's what the World Series does. Through the world in America. Okay, next question. This is from Laura Holmes. Overall opinions on Guild Ball are disgustingly positive. ! What are some things, if any, that you don't like? Alex, you can start us off on this.
I would like to see the game not very easily devolve into a scrum in the center. I think that's a really big, that's a thing that I've seen in a lot of games play that ball, you know, we talked a little bit about this on Twitter, but ball play, quote unquote, is a really important aspect of the game and can give you a really big edge. But, a lot of the game is played in the middle of the pitch. And I would kind of like to see maybe a little bit wider formation, maybe a little bit more interesting ball play out of the game, because if I want an exclusively combat game, I can find that somewhere where I already maybe have an entire army of exclusively combat models. So that's probably my biggest complaint right now, is just how much like center scrumming there is, or in how easily it can just kind of devolve into that and the ball can just be ignored largely.
Carl, you have any thoughts on that?
So as far as something that's not disgustingly positive, I don't like the fact that they don't have an alternate sculpt for brisket in a bathtub to catch the tears of your opponent in.
Okay. I
think Bevan would agree
You had to break our streak of...
We got one episode.
Well, I guess on the bright side, you didn't mention drinking her bathwater, so I guess we've got that going for us.
We have to replace the sign now. Paint over the one and put zero.
Yeah. It's been zero episodes since Brisket's bathwater has been mentioned. You know, she asked, what are the things, if any, that you don't like about it? You know, so far, the game still kind of has its new car smell about it. So, you know, down the road, there may be things that end up getting on my nerves more. But right now, most things I'm actually feeling really good about. I do agree that there is kind of the scrum in the middle of the table issue, but I think that some of that is probably my own fault in when it comes to these games, just because I'm taking the things that I know from other miniature games and applying it to Guild Ball.
Mm-hmm.
And while it is effective, I don't know that it's necessarily the most effective way to play the game. So, I don't know. I think that that's something that's interesting, something that can, hopefully with more play, I think that more strategies are going to be, gone over and developed. So I'm not necessarily super worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
Alex, why don't you ask us the question?
I don't really want to ask that question. I like that question that much. Oh my gosh, I should have been thinking about this.
Yes, you should have.
Chris Miller asked, do you ever consider leaving a taken out player off a round for a second Icy Sponge token?
Yes.
All the time.
Yeah, I do it every game.
That's kind of a situational awareness kind of thing. You have to obviously stop and look and be like, okay, well, if I bring this 15 total health model back to the table with 5, are they just going to turn around and kill them again? I think Cosset is a really good example of this, where she does not have a ton of health. She is not overly defensive. She can die super, super, super easily, but she's extraordinarily good at what she does. So you're really encouraged to bring her back onto the table and charge something and try and kill it, right? But a lot of times that can ultimately lead to just her dying again. So you know, if you don't have Miraculous Recovery or any of those things, like, you almost desperately need to keep her off the table for a second Icy Sponge token.
Okay. I think that was a good enough answer. We can...
Yes, easy questions.
Okay. Carl, ask us a question.
All right. Reading into the mic this time.
Hooray!
Says, Johnny Bridle says, how do you plan for games where your game plan is 1, 2, or 3 goals respectively? Then in parentheses, how you build the team, how many big guys, strikers, etc. I think that absolutely depends on the team you're playing and your play style. When I play Fisherman,
the plan's 3 goals.
I don't have any need for big guys. Just crushing the goal all the time.
Okay. So,
you know, I don't think I've ever gone into a game thinking I want to score 3 goals or I want to score 2 or 1 goals. And like thinking about what that split actually is. And maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that this is, again, probably my own penchant for wanting to have a scrum in the middle of the table, but a lot of times I have had the plan of I'm going to try to probably take out around 4 players and score 1 goal. So
might be time for you to play some different guilds, Jay.
Yeah, maybe. Or play them differently. I mean, I've been... The guild I've played the most of has been Union, and they can have a pretty diverse play style, so.
But they kind of lean towards Murder Squad a little bit, right? Like, they've got, you know, they have Mist, who's, like, arguably one of the better strikers in the game, but they definitely have the tools to just straight murder lots of people. Yeah, so I don't necessarily think that's a failing on your part so much as it is, I agree with what Carl said. Maybe it's time to try a different guild or a different build.
You can call me a failure. It's okay.
I think it's important in Guild Ball to just stay super fluid. Like, I don't necessarily know that even going into the game thinking I have to score 2 goals and get 2 kills or I'm not going to win this game, because the state of the game can change very, very rapidly, right, in ways, yeah, that you might not predict just because of how kick drifts work and everything like that. So I think it's important. Like, how you can go in with a game plan for sure. Like, to, you know, get one goal and kill math dudes, 4 dudes. But it's super, super important to know that could very easily, like, not happen and be able to adapt to it.
So he kind of touches on this a little bit with his question, but let me take it a little bit more pointed. He mentions like the different positions, and so I'm going to confess that, you know, I'm not a soccer person, fan, player, etc. by any means. And so, you know, the different positions like striker and etc., they're pretty much all Greek to me. But do you think that when you are composing your team that there is a position composition that matters in when making your team?
I don't believe there is. I think it all depends on the matchup. I think who you're going to play against and then knowing your playbook. If you know what abilities you need or you know what goals you need to accomplish in the game to win, I don't necessarily think it matters if you have a team of all strikers or
I agree with you, but I think it's important to know that if you have a team of all strikers, you better as hell not get in combat because you're going to get your shit beat. Like, I think it's super important. Like, I personally like a balanced team. I like, you know, I like a couple of people who can score a goal. I really want one goaltender or center back or like a good defensive midfielder, something that I can use on defense, because god damn it, I hate getting scored on because it feels like such a failure to me of like, how did I not see or how was I unable to stop this goal? So for me, I completely agree with you, Carl, in that like it really comes down to how you want to play the game. And like, you can play a really aggressive game, but it's very, very important to understand that you're going to have holes and weaknesses as a result of that. So if you put together that team of all strikers and you're getting beaten, like, you can't blame your team composition necessarily on that, right? You can blame a lot of how you're playing that game.
Okay. So next question, we have a question from Campbell Dandy. Do you think there is an advantage to being a beater style team because then the position of the ball is not relevant? Or is it much like War Machine and Hordes, where there is always a counter to each team slash play style, maybe even highlight the play styles? So it kind of feels like there's, when most people talk about the game, they feel like there's three play styles with guilds that fall within a spectrum on those play styles. So you have the beaters, you have the scorers, and you have the control aspects. That's a 5-minute warning. Do you think that that's a fair breakdown of the play styles?
Yeah.
Okay. So then that leads to his next question of, do you think that the beaters have an advantage over the other play styles?
I don't think so. I think a savvy player will realize that you're going to come at them aggressively, and he will use the positioning of his models to dictate the positioning of your models, controlling the flow of the game.
Yeah, I agree. I think that like, while I just complained that maybe the game can devolve a little bit too much into a center scrum, I don't feel like at any point the position of the ball is not relevant. I think the position of the ball is always relevant because a goal is worth more than a kill, and goals take less time to kind of manufacture than kills do, frankly. Like, models in this game, unless you're like against a stack, like, don't die that fast, unless, you know, there are obvious exceptions to that. But as far as there being an advantage, a lot of it depends on what you're playing against, right? Like, if you're playing against the fisherman, the position of the ball is super relevant, and there's not necessarily an advantage to being a beater. But if you're, like, if we go back to the Butcher's Brewers thing, and you're both trying to be beater-style teams in the middle of the table, then, yeah, I think there is an advantage to being the better beater, but at the same time, like, if you're both doing it, then there's not that much of an advantage. Like, so, like, I feel like, you know, we talked in the last episode a little bit about balance, but I feel like the teams that use the ball really well completely remove the advantage to being a beater team, right? And the balls that don't, like, then obviously there's no advantage because you're both doing the same thing.
I think I concur that it is, I don't necessarily think that one type is favored over the other. So let's say someone is playing a beater, and someone's playing control. And there's definitely, it feels like I've had matchups where I've been playing control versus a beater game, where when I've done things effectively, that they're just completely taken out of their game, and that I have the advantage. And likewise, you know, let's say that you're looking for goals. There's a lot of games where it's pretty realistic for you to score two goals on the same turn back to back, and you're 2/3 of the way to victory. And so, you know, someone could very easily be saying, you know, what about this fucking goal scoring? This is totally broken. What, how can anyone think this is fair, et cetera? So, you know, I do think that it's, I don't think that the beaters necessarily are have a strong advantage over everyone else. So let's do one final question of a shorty, so that since we are low on time, but we'll go with William Anderson. How do your early plays of Guild Ball compare to your early plays of War Machine and Hordes? So Alex, why don't you go first?
Guild Ball's been a lot easier because I have years of War Machine and Hordes experience, which have kind of informed my expectations of what miniatures games are. So it's kind of helped me kind of grasp onto these rules really easily. But, you know, I've never played in a really competitive scene yet, so I don't know necessarily how that's going to be. Probably awful like it was for War Machine and Hordes, but we'll see. We'll see.
I do think one of the things that War Machine is struggling with right now is that if someone jumps into the game at this moment right now, they have hundreds and hundreds of models to learn. And, you know, there's not just the learning the game, then there's learning the rules. And so someone jumping into Guild Ball right now, definitely the barrier to entry feels much more manageable than in War Machine currently. So I do think that is something of a boon that the Guild Ball has going for it right now. Carl, what are some of your thoughts?
My experience is parallel Alex's. Jumping into the game now, I have lots of experience in War Machine, and it makes picking this game up, playing it, much more intuitive, having much more success than I did when I played War Machine initially.
Well, you also jumped into a War Machine community that had been active for years versus being one of the starting up members of Guild Ball, which can also have a pretty big difference in how things play out as well.
Yep, absolutely.
Let me ask real quickly. So you had less time, so now we're going to go into bonus time, a few minutes for a conclusion.
What happened to being lazy and unprofessional, Jay?
Oh, my bad.
We'll still find a way to be lazy and unprofessional, I'm sure.
So you had played some other miniatures games before Guild Ball. Did you feel that those games, before War Machine, did you feel that those games helped you transition into War Machine as much as War Machine has helped you transition into Guild Ball?
No, I don't think so. I didn't play those other games long enough to really get my foot in, to get a good holding. I played it long enough to get a flavor of the game and move on from it.
Okay. So do you have any closing thoughts on for this week, Carl?
I got nothing. I'm empty.
You're so lazy and unprofessional. Alex, what about you?
Not really. No. Okay. Closing thoughts. Have fun.
My closing thought, go to Momentous Play on Facebook, like us, and then next time we do a post asking for questions, do a post, and you'll be able to join in the fun.
We should get Josh on here to do a dojo throw out.
And a dad joke at the end.
Oh, no. No, don't do it.
Thanks for listening to Momentous Play. Tune in next week for another 30-minute podcast about Guild Ball.